Well, good morning, and my thanks to the organizers for allowing me to return to this lovely city and wonderful conference and workshop. This is the first of maybe a little bit of stuff on vanadium oxide and some related kinds of materials, so I thought that I should give a bit of background. Many of you know what I will say, and I won't spend too long, but not all of you may be familiar with this particular material. I have lots of people involved in the collaboration. You'll notice a number of people from Osaka University, and that is of extreme importance in this work, as you'll see as we go along. Samples coming from Patricia Metcalf at Purdue, and a theory collaboration that's been very exciting for me. My student Sung Kwan Mo and Jonathan Denlinger is a former postdoc and now still a close collaborator in this work. So this is the famous V2O3 phase diagram, which was introduced to the world by a group at Bell Labs in the late 60s and early 70s. There are three phases: an insulator, a metal, and an antiferromagnetic insulator. One has a nice relationship between chromium doping and titanium doping in this system that seems to mimic the effect of pressure. This is particularly important to system because one could study an insulator to metal transition where there was no magnetism involved. And so this was taken then as the prototype of the Mott transition. And it was interpreted by these people in terms of the one-band Hubbard model within the framework of the theory that Brinkman and Rice put forth in the early 70s. There have been some further developments of what happens to the phase diagram with changing oxygen to vanadium stoichiometry, and I won't talk about that, but this is, of course, also a very interesting aspect of the system. So some standard history. I already mentioned the work by McQuan and Rice and their collaborators. They ignored orbital degeneracy and made a one-band Hubbard model, and there were some arguments for how to get rid of the effect of one electron and produce an S equals one-half model. In the late 70s, Castellani and his co-workers worried about this issue and made some arguments again for how to get rid of the one electron, but this involved some orbital ordering. And then in the late 90s, early 90s and on into the 90s, we had this new development with the dynamic mean field theory, again one band Hubbard, and analysis of optical spectroscopy and some early UV photoemission data. So I don't have to show you this diagram or say anything about it beyond just to remind you that it makes a different spectroscopic picture for how the insulator metal transition happens, that instead of collapsing the Hubbard gap, one can grow a quasi-particle peak in the gap, and there is supposed to be some temperature dependence. There were early efforts in photoemission to look for this temperature dependence, but the early photoemission never showed a peak, and so it was pretty hard to study the temperature dependence of something that you really couldn't see. So I mentioned already some issues of realism, and maybe this will be helpful to George in the talk that he's going to give, just to say that you have three orbitals per ion that are relevant. You have four ions per unit cell and two electrons per ion. So you have 24 states per cell and 8 electrons per cell. And so this doesn't look much like a one-band Hubbard model. The idea that floated around in this business and may still have some relevance in some way is that the cubic T states split into E's and A's under the trigonal crystal field. And then one thought about a large bonding, antibonding splitting involving ions close together along the C-axis. And then you could, if you made this bonding, antibonding splitting big for the states that lay along the C-axis, you could spin pair them and be left with a half-filled E-band. And that's the problem that you have to solve in this business. And there were lots of clever models, I would say, based on looking at this situation, and I think about John Goodenough and Herb Zeiger, and I already mentioned the work by Castellani, trying to deal with this situation, which is what we have come to now. In the late 90s, we had newer work realizing that this multiband models were important. There was theoretical work by Etzoff et al. That's work that George was involved with, some X-ray scattering, some work by Jae-hoon Park and his collaborators, and again involving theory done by George to analyze the data, all of which went in the direction of saying that you didn't have a spin half, that you had a spin one, you had complicated occupations of the E's and the A's, and you should worry about that, that it was important for the physics. There are two analytical kinds of models that focus on C-axis pair states, which introduce kind of dynamic mixes of occupations of these orbitals and build in S equals one. And then, perhaps most recently, some work by Carsten Held and his collaborators, Dieter Fohlhardt and others, introducing dynamic mean field theory to LDA and building in this multiband realism, and then calculating the single particle spectrum. And they found that for the paramagnetic metal phase, they got pretty good agreement with 60 EV photoemission data, and that's kind of the evolving story of that is what I want to tell you. In the photoemission, there was early evidence that there were interesting bulk surface differences in some work that Jae-hoon Park did with me in his thesis. And in particular, he did some early work at 500 EV and also at lower photon energies on the Dragon beamline at the NSLS, and now a defunct beamline. And he saw hints of something a little bit peaky at the chemical potential, but the resolution was really not so good, and so it wasn't possible to follow this up very well. So then we come now to what's probably the centerpiece of, or one of the centerpieces of this work, and that is the development at Spring 8 by Professor Suga and his colleagues of a beamline which would work at high photon energies and give quite good resolution so that one could try to do more bulk sensitive work with reasonable resolution. And so I was very pleased to have the opportunity to take some samples of V203 to Spring 8 in Japan and work on that beamline. And these are the kinds of, we had 90 millivolts of resolution and we cleaved the samples in good vacuum and so on and so forth. And so this is the story that I'll be telling you about today. We did some initial work, and our focus was in the idea that we would get good statistics by working around vanadium 2p edge. That's a way to get a very large enhancement in the cross-section for vanadium photoemission. This is an off-resonant spectrum and an on-resonant spectrum, and you see here a huge enhancement. And so the idea was that we would simply work at the resonance edge, get good statistics, have quite good bulk sensitivity, and that would be great. What we found was that when we measured with not such good statistics the off-resonant spectrum, that's these green dots here, that it was essentially, we thought, the same as the on-resonant spectrum, that's the red ones. This is the insulator and this is the metal. And so we thought that the on-resonance spectrum gave us the 3D spectral function. And we went ahead and we made a comparison to the dynamic mean field theory calculations. That's the ones in blue. And we had pretty good agreement, little details like a peak below the chemical potential, stuff like that, which we thought were good. And in fact, the agreement was a little bit better than with the 60 EV spectrum used before. And I thought that this was truth. And we put a preprint on the web. And we're ready to move on and try to do angle-resolved photoemission. So as a first step to that, we took some samples to the ALS and tried to get a start on that program there, even though the resolution on the beamline at the ALS was not so good. And this is now an example of what can happen to you with experimental physics, I think, and doing everything as well as you think you know how to do, there are still surprises to be had. And perhaps it's also a lesson in the seductiveness of the agreement between theory and experiment, making you think everything's okay. So this is real life revealed to you now. So the first surprise that came when we measured a lot of detailed spectra that we hadn't seen before was that we saw evidence of Auger transitions. That's these lines that move when plotted on a binding energy. And this OJ stuff was coming in over the resonance range where we thought we didn't have any bad contributions to the spectra before. So that was shock number one. And shock number two was that when we measured the spectrum in the paramagnetic metal phase, and we saw here a huge peak at the chemical potential. It's simply never been seen before. And I remember thinking to myself that if I show this spectrum to the theorists, they'll simply faint dead away because this doesn't look anything like what the theory had been producing. So that was a big shock. And of course, you when you see something like this, completely different from what you thought you knew, you say, what could be happening? I can't just go to another synchrotron and get completely different physics. Well, was it somehow a special photon energy? We did find that at this photon energy, we had a somewhat of an enhancement of the cross-section here. Some KZ dependence, I'll mention in a minute. And we thought maybe the major difference was that the spot size on this particular beamline, it's a spectral microscopy beamline, was about 100 microns. And we also found it mattered a lot where you put the beam on the sample. And the size of the peak changed a lot with where you were. And we had a 1 millimeter beam at spring 8 in this initial work. So I didn't know what to think at that point, but we had beam time again at spring 8 in April. And so that was a couple of months later. So we went back to spring 8 and really with the feeling that we pray we can sort this out. And we got very lucky. We had actually planned to focus on doing angle resolved photoemission, but instead we went back and had a look at what we had done before. And we had very good fortune that in the meantime, the beamline had been modified to decrease the spot size from a millimeter down to 100 micron, same as at the ALS. And it turned out that really made the difference. We found that the spot size also increased the photon intensity, so we could measure off resonance with much better signal to noise before, and really utilize the full high resolution photon energy range that makes this beamline unique. And we did indeed find now that there was clearly easily seen effects of OJ in the resonance line shape. It's not a huge effect, or we would have seen it before. These differences between the blue and the red are the kinds of differences that one finds. There are little tails down here, which are OJ emission. Here in the metallic phase, it's a bigger effect. And you can see that this kind of difference was hidden in the poor statistics of the off-resonant spectrum that we had before. This peakiness below the chemical potential is the result of an OJ transition there. So in that sense, it's an artifact. Let me say a little bit about K-space now before moving on. This is a plot of the Brillouin zone stacking perpendicular to the cleavage plane. And as you may know, what happens in photoemission is that if you fix the photon energy and you vary the analyzer angles, you sweep on spherical surfaces in K-space. And so these are arcs of the spherical surfaces that you move on for the various photon energies. We're setting the analyzer to cover this much angle, and so in this direction that takes in several Brillouin zones. And I will show you, since we are comparing to an angle integrated theory, we decided to measure over a range of photon energy that would also span a Brillouin zone. So this blob of stuff takes in easily more than one Brillouin zone, and I'll show you some K average spectra over this range, although that turns out not to be the dominantly important effect. We avoid the resonant photoemission range that we had worked in before, which is in this region, exactly because we don't want to contaminate the spectra with the OJ signals. So we did verify the ALS result that at 310 EVs there's a peakiness in the overall cross section. But we do now find with the small spots and moving around on the sample and getting a good place, we do find now the large peak at the chemical potential, which is the interesting thing from the point of view of this meeting and having a quasi-particle peak coming up in the metal phase. Here's a sequence of spectra taken from 380 eV to 500, and you can see there is some non-monotonic variation here over this range, but this is the set of data that we'll average to get a K-average spectrum. So the solid line is the K-average spectrum, and the wiggly line is the one at 700 eV, and there is some difference in peak height here, which one could imagine might involve some KZ. Maybe there's a special KZ place you're picking up at 700 eV that makes this particularly tall, but that I think is not the case, and I'll argue to you that in the next slide. So here's a plot in which we have removed an inelastic background in the same way from all the data, and we have normalized them in this region here below the chemical potential. This is the peak, which would be called the incoherent peak in the dynamic mean field theory, and that's so you can see the relative height of the peaky thing at the chemical potential changing. And so as we go from 310 eV to 700, the averaged one is the spectrum C here, you can see that the peak height simply increases. That's the dominant effect. This is the spectrum at 60 eV to which the original theory was compared, and where there was fair agreement. This was in the PRL that Karsten and his colleagues published, and you can see that there's clearly something going to be a major disagreement between theory and experiment, at least as it looks up to this point. I just remarked that there is some non-monotonic variation and also below 300 eV, so there may well be KZ dependence, but the dominant effect in this range that I'm showing you is that as you make the photon energy higher, the peak gets bigger. So we believe that that's a surface sensitive effect, and we did try to check that. If we look at 500 eV and we increase the angle at which we collect the electrons, we take a very large hunk of analyzer space, so it looks like this much of a Brillouin zone. So we're not really doing angle-resolved photoemission. We're just tilting the angle at which we take the electrons in order to effectively change the probe depth. It's a cosine theta effect on the probe depth. And what we find is that as we do that and we rotate the theta out to a large angle, we see that this peak just goes down and becomes not quite as low as it is in the 60 eV spectrum, but it just gets systematically smaller. We could do 1 plus minus 15 1, and so this is, we think, all consistent with the idea that we're really seeing a surface sensitivity in the data. I should say that this doesn't analyze up quite so nicely as we'd like. There are ways to make models in which the escape depth just varies, or the probe depth varies like cosine theta. This doesn't quite go like that, even though it's a monotonic change, and I'll remark a little bit later why that might be the case. Yes?
I'm missing something. Previously, you showed three spectra at 300, 500, and 700. Yes, this one. And it was not monotonic variation, right?
Well, what's important is that you should compare that relative to that with the inelastic background taken out. And so it's misleading. Your eye is misleading you as to the relative heights. In fact, the 700 eV one is the peakiest one if you'll realize the overall amplitude is lower. And we didn't realize that either when we first just glanced at the data. You have to really make the plots and then see how it is before you know that's how it is. So, as I said, I thought that if I show this peaky thing to the theorists, they'll faint dead away. And in the meantime, what's happening in the theory group, when we have not made a formal collaboration, is that they are now realizing that it would be a good thing to do the calculations at a lower temperature. In fact, the original calculations were done, this should be 1160, were done at 1160 kelvins, and compared to this spectrum, this is the 1160 Kelvin spectrum, which not too bad, the comparison to a 60 eV spectrum. But this is a 300 Kelvin spectrum, and that's an 1160 Kelvin theory. And you see, it maybe wasn't too bad, but they then did the calculations, which turn out to be very expensive. As you know, this is quantum Monte Carlo, so it costs you a lot of computer time to do that. As you get to 300K, you see what happens is that the central peak really becomes peaky. It actually doesn't transfer terribly much spectral weight, according to some estimates the theorists have done, but it separates off and the width gets less, and it really becomes very dramatic, and now the difference between the 60 EV spectrum becomes enormous. So they're sitting there thinking, my gosh, we did a better calculation and the agreement's gone to hell. And I'm sitting there thinking, if I show them this data that we have gotten, they'll be very upset. And it's all honest physics, and it was pretty nice, at least at the qualitative level, that we now have quite a peaky thing in our experimental result. We think we're really probing the bulk, and the theory produces something really peaky now. But you can now, of course, do quantitative comparisons that we never could do before. And that then gets interesting and takes you to the next level in this business. So there's, I think, good qualitative agreement on the presence of a prominent peak in the spectrum. And that part is, of course, very nice for a person like myself who worked on the chondroresonance and cerium materials. It's nice to see things like this coming up at the chemical potential in the experiments. It's really clear that the experimental peak width is larger by almost a factor of 2, and that actually, I think, is a serious issue for the long-term understanding of this material and the phase transition and the energetics that go into the phase transition. And one could imagine something like a K-dependent self-energy perhaps contributing to this extra width, and we have thought a little bit about C-axis pairs as a beginning to get at this K-dependence. But perhaps the larger issue is not automatic, not the width per se, but the experimental peak weight is larger than the theory weight. It's clear by eye that there's just more weight here in the experiment than there is in the theory. And in order to get that amount of weight, never mind the details of the width, to be right, you have to reduce the U value within the DMFT scheme, and that U value will then be so small that if you now try to calculate in the phase where it should be an insulator, it will still be a metal. So there is a non-trivial quantitative issue raised by the comparison we can make. So on the one hand, I think we're all feeling very good about having a peak, and it's exciting from the point of view of the spectroscopy to see something we never saw before. But there remains now some new things to deal with about the energetics of the transition. And that's just an exciting aspect that I think we'll continue to work with. Say a little bit about the surface stuff. The cleavage plane is the 101 bar 2 cleavage plane. That's this thing shown in purple. And if you actually look at the way the atoms are arranged, this is a side view, and this is a top view, and these blue and green ones are vanadiums, and the big red balls are oxygens. And so you can see that there really are vanadiums right up on the surface, and they'll have a different environment than they have in the bulk. And so that's a possibility for why we see such big surface effects. This has a thickness of a little more than 2.5 angstroms. And for typical escape depths at 700 EVs, if this was the only surface effect, we should be now having spectra with something like maybe only a 15% contribution from this surface layer. But there is another effect which I think is important, and we kind of know that has to be true. In the original ALS data that I showed you, which was taken at 310 EV, which is relatively low compared to 700, we actually got on a one-time only basis the biggest peak we've ever seen so far. I have to say this is a lucky cleave in a small photon spot. It's not reproduced this far. It's a one-time observation. And I'll hint to you in a minute the possibility that if you had a really smooth surface, you might possibly be able to do work at lower photon energies, which would make it easier to do angle-resolved photoemission. So what's going on with this spot stuff? These are high-resolution optical micrographs of typical cleave surfaces of this material. It's the material most everybody uses in this business. You see that this is 2.6 by 2 millimeters field of view, and the surfaces are pretty rough. And you can find here regions that are reasonably smooth And what happens is that this is now 100 micron spot size, and you can see that if you make the spot size that small, you can begin to find regions which are relatively free of these obvious steps and cracks and crevices in the material. And so this is the kind of thing we're doing when we use a small spot, is that we're finding places on the sample where you have a reasonable amount of freedom from this kind of thing. This is pure V2O3, this one. Here's some chromium doped V2O3, and for some reason the chromium doped samples seem to give nicer cleaves. The crystal growers actually tell us that chromium doping seems to be easier from the point of view of getting homogeneous material, and they don't understand why that is, but the chromium doped samples do seem to have fewer of these terraces. And so, for example, here are a couple of different materials, and now you see that this is 100 micron spot size, and you can see we're taking in not so many of these guys. And this, I think, is an indication of why it is when we tilt the detector angle, we don't just see a coast state of variation in the signal, because what happens as you tilt is you also spread out the footprint of the beam. And so you can see if you had, for example, something like this, you would increase the number of steps and stuff, and that means that the the effective surface sensitivity in the spectra would go up by more than just a geometrical effect of probing into the sample a little less deeply. So this is the kind of thing that I think is going on when we say it's important to have a small spot for these materials. Okay, so let's now look a little bit at data about the phase transition itself. This is the famous 1.2% sample where one has reentrant behavior, and at this particular value, as you just vary the temperature, you can go from the insulator magnetic phase to the paramagnetic metal to the paramagnetic insulator, so you can move through all three phases. These are the overall spectra, the metal and the two insulators, so you can see there's a gap opens up, easily seen, that's well known. And you can see also that there is a difference in the size of the gap in the AFI and the PI phase. This is now 2.8% chromium, and we're moving out into the phase diagram here, and the reason for that is that the theory that was done was actually done at 3.8%, and we want to try to move in the direction of having a better comparison to the theoretical work that's been done for the insulator phase, calculations that were made at a high temperature and are working there where they are working their way down in temperature. Here we have an interesting new effect that comes in, and that is that we see chromium-3 de-emission in the spectra. If we measure off resonance, which frees us from the Auger contributions, that's these blue lines, then we see a little a rounding here, and that actually is chromium-3 de-emission. When we go on resonance, we suppress the chromium-3 de-emission, so we get the red line, but then we pick up these Auger things. So there's no magic photon energy now where you can just work and it's truth. You always have some extra thing to struggle with. It's maybe a little bit surprising that 3D emission is so big. Here now is a comparison, of the PM to PI transition. So it's pure V2O3 in the metal phase, move out at almost the same temperature to the insulator phase, the PI phase. So this is supposed to be the Mott transition. That's the comparison of the spectra. Here's the little blob, which is the chromium 3D emission. And let me just comment. I think it's surprising at first glance that 2.8% chromium actually produces emission that you can see. You might have the feeling that that's a pretty small amount of chromium. Why should this be so easily visible? And maybe we're wrong. You know, perhaps it really isn't chromium 3D emission, but it really is. Here's some data that Jaehoon Park took a long time ago at the NSLS, in which he had a sample that was 1.8% chromium, and he found that even if he, with the lower resolution that he had, maybe he didn't see this chromium emission here, but he went to the chromium 2P edge, which is up somewhere around 574, 575 EVs, and switched off resonance to on resonance and saw this 3D emission coming up in this region. And he then compared that to CR203 XPS, and so it's pretty clear that this stuff coming up here really is the chromium emission, rather strong. I chatted about this a little bit with George at his 60th birthday party, and we had an idea for why that might be. And it kind of takes us back to the original pictures for these materials in terms of an Anderson model, and maybe it's good to recall that in this time when we're always looking just at low binding energy pictures for these systems. But the idea is that for CR203, it's a half-filled D shell, and so it's a particularly stable, like George was mentioning yesterday for gadolinium. And we rather think that perhaps with no hybridization, the D3 to D2 peak is lying below the oxygen states. And now you turn on hybridization and you put a little bit of stuff mixed into the oxygen band, but you leave the majority of the D weight sitting down here below the chemical potential, or below the bottom of the P band where we see it. B203, on the other hand, we think is a little bit towards the charge transfer side of this demarcation between charge transfer and Mott-Hubbard systems. And so suppose with no hybridization, the D2 to D1 peak lies a little bit into the oxygen band here. Now you turn on hybridization and you blow out bound states in an impurity model. This would be the equivalent of the Zhang Rice kind of things. And these guys blown out down here now are the objects that we're studying in photoemission and calling the D band. And because of the way this has worked, you've left behind a lot of D weight here. And so relatively, there may be a lot more chromium D weight down here than there is vanadium weight here. And maybe that's a reason why you see the chromium weight coming up so easily in this vanadium oxide spectrum. And maybe it's not a bad idea to remember that there's yet another level of less, less bare stuff or more bare stuff going on lurking around underneath the models we talk about. So here is maybe a blow-up of this PM to PI transition. This is now 500 EV spectra. A lot of our spectra are taken at 500 EVs, even though 700 EV is probably a better one. It's easier to work at 500 to take lots and lots of spectra there. And so many of the data I'll show you are for that. This is this chromium stuff. And if we make an assumption that we know that this should come down smoothly, or actually if we think that it should look like pure B203, we can do a little trick and subtract it out of there, just so you can see what I'm doing to produce what we think is probably a correct line shape for this spectrum. So we're measuring off resonance or on resonance in order to discriminate against the OJ. Sorry, saying that backwards. We're measuring off resonance so we don't get OJ, and then in consequence we're seeing the chromium emission, and I'm taking it out. So this is now the comparison of PM to PI, and from pure V203 to a chromium doping, which is comparable to what was done in the theory. And we're hoping that that's then a valid kind of comparison to make. So let's now look at the insulator phase. So this is chromium 2.8% paramagnetic insulator. Chromium 3.8% theory, U equals 5 EV. And at the moment, I have calculations done at 1100, and it should be 60 kelvins and 700 kelvins. And there actually is a 300K theory now, but I just don't have it to show you. But I'll show you something at a different U, a similar U. And so you can see, here's the high temperature insulator spectrum. This is the experimental result. And you can see two kinds of differences. There's a kind of two-peak character, I think, quite obvious here in the experiment, and something more of a one-peak character to the theory curve, except that there's this rounding here. And the theorists have told me, and I think that it's now clear that that's true, that this is legitimate high-temperature gap filling that tells you that this is really a many-body gap and not just a semiconductor gap where you're raising the temperature and making whole particle pairs across the gap. So there is a gap filling that goes on, and as you see, as they lower the temperature to 700 EV, this rounded stuff starts going away. And this part is beginning to show some agreement with the experiment. And you might think that if you could take the temperature low enough, the gap size might not turn out to be too bad in the comparison between theory and experiment. Here's one where I've tried to make apples and apples for the comparison as much as I can, and look at the metal phase and the insulator. So here's All data at 500 EV, so the spectra are all at 500 volts. That means this is a little bit peakier, a little less peaky in the experiment than it would be at 700, but it's not a huge effect. And this is the theory for 5 EVs at 300K, and this is the comparison I already showed you. And now I have a theory spectrum done at 4.8 EV at 300K, and one with a somewhat smaller U value. One has a theory where you've got a little bit of weight left here, but not very much, and a fairly good lining up there. But still, lots of discrepancy out in this region, and so it seems pretty clear that there needs to be yet some more improvement in the description of the insulator phase. But maybe this gap of something like a couple hundred millivolts, maybe that will turn out. In the theory, we'll have to see how this evolves. But that's kind of the current situation, except that I don't have the 300 Kelvin 5 EV data, the theory to plot here for you. But it will be something like that, I think, not hugely different. So we were interested, of course, in this issue of the gap filling. And in the early going, we wanted to see if we could do something with that. And this was not an experiment that we could do at Spring 8 to take the temperature up to 700 kelvins, but it is something that we could do in our home lab. Now, in the home lab, we can work with a helium lamp, and the photon energies here are 40 and 80 eV, which is pretty small. So we know it's surface sensitive. But on the other hand, the surface, we're pretty sure, is a more correlated surface. That means it tends, if anything, to be insulating. And so we thought that it's not a bad thing to study at low photon energies the insulator phase and see if we can detect this gap filling. If anything, it should be a stronger correlated surface. So it's, we think, a valid thing to try to look and see if we can see departures from that at the low photon energies. So this is a hard experiment to do. We have taken a 2.8% sample to be well into the insulator phase. It also turns out these surfaces seem to be more stable with heating. And we've changed from 300K to 750K, measured at 20 EV and 40 EV. And this is the kind of small change that we see, and I'll blow that up for you in just a minute. Of course, what you do is you heat it up and then you cool it down again. And see whether the spectrum repeats. And what we found was that the green and the blue were not quite the same before and after the experiment, but the difference is a tenth of an EV shift. So this is actually before and after, and a tenth of an EV shift, and we rather think that's saying that the surface pinning of the chemical potential is just changing in some way as a result of the heating, but we don't see any change in the spectra. And we think then that the changes that we're seeing between high and low temperatures are okay. That's the idea. So if I blow that up, it's this kind of difference that we see. At low temperatures, this rounds, this has a certain concavity, has a curvature in this direction, and at high temperatures, it has the opposite curvature. There is then a little difference in the height at the chemical potential. Same kind of effect, of course, at 20 EVs and 40 EVs. And this is now blown up a little bit more. And we've compared it to the insulator spectrum here by adding an inelastic background to the insulator spectrum. The effect is to produce something that actually looks pretty good. That is, this rounding, which is the filling in of the gap in the theory, is we think, this rounding and change of the curvature that's reversed. However, it looks better than it is. You see a single peak here in the theory curve, and it looks like a single peak in the experiment. And that aspect of it is a bit misleading. That's due to the low photon energy that we're using. But the part I want you to remember is this change of curvature that we think is this gap filling at high temperatures. Now, this is a whole collection of spectra in the insulator phase for various photon energies and surface preparations. And so these are the kinds of high photon energy spectra that we have gotten at Spring 8. And these are helium lamp spectra. These ones here are 20 EVs. This is extra background that always is seen in the 20 EV spectra. These are 40 EV ones, tails coming down here. And it's kind of interesting. The difference between high photon energy and helium lamp data is that this peak near the chemical potential comes down in the more correlated surface layer. It's sort of like what happens in the metal phase, except we're looking at the leading peak below the chemical potential. And I think at this point we have no idea from theory why that should be, because we don't have a theory that really shows us a two-peak kind of a spectrum. But that's what seems to happen experimentally as the difference between the two. And that aspect is just this two-peak character in the insulator seems not to be reproduced in the theories. I have just a few minutes left, and I want to mention two other topics that may be germane to things that will be coming up. And that's a little bit of early stuff that I was involved with, and so just wanted to mention to you, and maybe things that aren't so well known and should be known. This has to do with this idea that maybe the near neighbor pairs along the C-axis, that's this guy and this guy, could be of some importance. But I just wanted to mention that if you measure a magnetic insulator like CR203 or nickel oxide, a real Mott Hubbard insulator, the spectrum really looks, the optical spectrum really looks like that of a nickel 2 plus or a chromium 3 plus impurity in, say, Al203 for chromium oxide or MgO for nickel. And you can simply measure the dilute system, understand all of the details of its crystal field spectrum and ionic spectrum, increase the concentration, and you will find subtle changes in the concentrated system, but no global differences from what you would have measured for the impurity. And so it's very easy to make a picture in which you say, I have localized, in quotation marks, 3D electrons, and of course the insulator then looks the concentrated insulator looks like that of the impurity. I noticed a long time ago when I was a young guy and people were first working on this V203 system that if you look at the V203 optical spectra in the AFI phase and the PI phase, they simply don't look like a vanadium 3 plus impurity. You can put vanadium 3 plus in Al203 and measure a spectrum that's just like you would expect to see it based on things everybody knows about the ionic spectra of these material. And that's really different. In V203, the optical spectrum is just quite different. So the sense that I had about this is that somehow the insulator phases don't know that they're made out of vanadium 3 plus ions. And I use the words that the vanadium 3 plus identity is somehow lost in V203. So I got Tom Reed at Lincoln Lab, which is where I was at that time, to make some samples of aluminum vanadium oxide. And one of the things we discovered is that there's a miscibility gap in the system. It's not like ruby. You can't just make any concentration of X you want. You can make samples up to about 0.08, and then there's a miscibility gap that extends up to about X equals 0.8. What I found was, studying these samples where X was less than 0.08, is that the vanadium 3 plus identity is actually retained for all of these spectra. Now, if you look, you might say 0.08% isn't very much. If you look, you see that it's pretty interesting the way the statistics go. You have one first near neighbor, but if you look at the seconds, the thirds, and the fourths, there are three thirds, there are three seconds, and then there are six fourth near neighbors. Here's the fourth, the fourth, the fourth, and the fourth, the fourth, the fourth. This is relative to this reference ion here. So there are a lot of these second, third, and fourth near neighbors. And at 8%, it turns out that there are very, very many of these near neighbor pairs. So I have, at 8%, succeeded in putting many vanadium atoms close to one another at the level of second, third, and fourth near neighbors. These are all coupled by a single oxygen. So that's why fourth is the furthest out you can go and still couple through one oxygen. So I inferred from that if you make, say, this one and this one, or this and this, or that and that, that the coupling between them is not enough to mess up the vanadium 3 plus spectrum. And I argued that the vanadium 3 plus identity is then retained for these. And then I thought that perhaps it's in the first near neighbor pairs that you begin to break down the vanadium 3 plus identity, which seems to be lost in V203. There aren't very many first neighbor pairs at 8% because there's only one along the C-axis. So that was the idea here, that maybe pointed towards this this near-neighbor pair as being an important way to get you the electronic structure of pure V2O3. Now, since then, people are now working on this, and I think George will talk about aspects of this issue in his talk. There's some work from downfolding from Sasha and from Anisimov, and they are getting hoppings to the second, third, and fourth neighbors the order of a tenth of an EV. And the first neighbor, AA, splitting or hopping is 0.55 EV. If I would translate that into T squared over U and just think what's the ratio of the J associated with the first couplings and the J associated with these other ones, it's a difference of 30. So there is a real difference at the level of looking at one of these connected to one of those or one of these connected to one of those. But Anisimov, on the other hand, makes the point, same as I've already said to you, you got a lot of these seconds, thirds, and fourths. So by the time you realize that they all contribute in V2O3 with a tenth of an EV, you've built up an enormous contribution to the total bandwidth from all the rest of these near neighbors. And so it may be that V2O3, it's really important to just put a lot of ions in the crystal so that you have all of these paths operating together, producing whatever the total electronic structure is. I don't know how this is going to play out finally, but I think it's an interesting issue for these systems. And one more little tidbit for the last 2 minutes. Just recently was a preprint of a paper by Ladd et al., which is another dynamic mean field theory plus LVA calculation, in which they emphasize that getting a first-order phase transition might involve the changing trigonal distortion through the metal insulator transition in V2O3. And there may be some relevance to this idea of some results, again, that came from early work that I did on CR203, and you might find this an interesting phenomena. You can induce spin flop in CR203 with uniaxial stress. So you remember how this spin flop thing goes. You have spins that are antiferromagnetic, say, along a uniaxis, the C-axis, and you put on a B field which is smaller than a critical B, and nothing happens. And that's because the B field hasn't overcome the magnetic anisotropy coefficient K yet. And then when you make the B field big enough so that the field energy overcomes the anisotropy energy, the spins flop and cant a little bit. And this phenomenon is well known in CR203. What I found in essence is that if I apply stress in the basal plane, then I can make the spins flop. And how did I know that? Well, I was studying the chromium 3 plus optical excitons, and this is what happens to these exciton lines. You get a sudden change as you go through the spin flop field, and quite by accident, one time towards the end of my thesis work, I discovered that if you squeeze with uniaxial stress, you can make the same thing happen to the spectrum, except that you don't get Zeeman splittings that are associated with the magnetic field. And so one infers that uniaxial stress can make the spins flop. So what's happening? The flop field is proportional to an anisotropy constant, which is the sum of a dipolar term and a single ion term. And the single ion term is actually proportional to the trigonal crystal field splitting V. That's the AE splitting that we talk about in V2O3, and two powers of the spin orbit coupling, which I don't mention to you. And so the picture would be that if you can drive the magnetic anisotropy to zero, then the spins will spontaneously flop. Or equivalently, one would say that the flop field is stress dependent. The way it works is that if you stretch the system along the C-axis, the flop field actually will get smaller. If you squeeze along the C-axis, the flop field gets bigger. And if you stress in the basal plane, then you can make the spins flop, or you can drive the anisotropy to zero. And so the idea is that it must be so that basal plane stress is driving the anisotropy constant to zero and the spins flop, and probably you're stressing the trigonal crystal field. Maybe not driving the AE splitting all the way to zero because there's another contribution here, but this is a hint to you that the AE splitting is very strain dependent in the corundum structure. And so maybe in CR203, this strain dependence of the trigonal crystal field manifests itself as an effect on the magnetic anisotropy, because you can't really change the orbital occupation since you've got three electrons filling the T-shell, so the A's and the E's are always filled, but you can mess around with the magnetic anisotropy. And in V2O3, maybe the strain depends on the AE splitting plays an important role in the metal insulator transition as discussed by these guys. I don't know. Anyway, that was the other little vignette that I wanted to mention to you. And I'll put the summary here, but my time is over, so I should stop, but I think you can read all these things that I already told you. Thank you very much.
Development. Question?
How bad things are without you? Didn't come out quite right. I mean, these intensities, if you put the U equals zero, they're going to be terrible. What the comparison with the experiment?
If you just do LDA, then just straight comparison to LDA, it'll look pretty bad. That's a fair statement, Karsten?
Yes, so you don't have the upper band or the spectral range.
It'll be a little bit like what happens with cerium. You do LDA for cerium and you just really won't see anything very much. Or plutonium maybe is not quite so bad, but yeah. So from my point of view, having this theory that's built on a realistic underlying electronic structure and still putting in the dynamic effects that at some level of exactness is wonderful. It's really exciting for me to, as a spectroscopist, to have this kind of theory to compare to.
But it might have been worthwhile to put it on the same graph, the LDA and the...
Yes, you can see that. You can see that. Yeah, it's a good point. You can see that in the PRL that Karsten and his colleagues wrote, there is such a comparison. Yeah, I could have done that. I should have. I could have lifted that picture out of their PRL. I should have done. Sorry about that. Yeah.
It would be the spin splitting. Spin polarization. LDA doesn't work.
Ah, so there will be an idea of the comparison of it really will
LDA, yeah, and this is what you would see in total emission. So you have to add these two together, sort of just one at a time.
It's a spin polarized calculation.
So where is
this is LDA, which gives you a non-magnetic metallic ground state.
Yes.
So even after subtraction of this chromium background, you see this double peak structure field.
Yes. Right? Yes. The insulator is always showing some kind of two-shouldered feature, which is best. I think it's a fair statement that just seems not to be. The hint of that in the theory at high temperatures was this gap filling. And as you decrease the temperature, the hint of a two-featured spectrum just goes away as the gap is no longer filled, and you're left with something that's basically a single peak. I mean, it's the lower Hubbard band. So somehow it's as though there's structure in the lower Hubbard band that we seem not to be seeing in the theory, and we're also finding that it matters how much the correlation is, at least because the more surface-sensitive data show a difference in the relative heights of these two shoulders. I think that's a fair summary of the situation.
I think there is some theories which predict two peaks in the insulator. Probably LBO calculated.
Actually, I have discussed that because you suggested that to me when I was in Japan maybe a year and a half ago. So I followed it up, of course, which I do every suggestion that you make to me. I always pay attention. And I discussed that a little with Karsten and Dieter. And what they explained to me was that second peak comes when you calculate for the antiferromagnetic insulator phase. And so there is something like a quasi-particle peak because it's magnetically ordered. But for the PI phase, they think, one would not expect such a spectrum because it's a disordered phase. So that's, is that a Have I said that right, Karsten? I think that's what you guys...
It's a basic thing. Just very close to the insulator, you have kind of also shown you something. But let's see, general statement.
Okay.
I presume the comparison between theory and experiment still at the level of some kind of Bohr spectral function that is being calculated. Now, obviously, the theory of photoemission is quite like that. It's a one-step process, and that those people who have done one-step process calculations see a great richness of peaks and shoulders showing up because what happens as the electron is getting out and the surfaces and so on. So when the issues are as high profile ones as these ones, probably those kind of photoemission calculations should be done.
As best as I know, the calculations which are done in a one-step framework are always done for a true one-electron theory. So they try to build in, for example, the matrix elements, and maybe you're thinking of something like that. There are two issues, crudely speaking. One is the matrix element for getting the electron out of the solid and into whatever free electron state it's in. And then the second, I think you're alluding to, is the issue of the sudden approximation. So as you go to higher and higher photon energies, you expect the sudden approximation to get better and better. And I guess that if you would have a deviation from the sudden approximation working, it should tend to actually put more weight at low photon at low binding energies as you go to lower and lower kinetic energies of the outgoing electron. So suppose I take the electron out infinitely slowly, then the system constantly adjusts as the electron goes out. And so you're always in the ground state, and that means that at true adiabaticity, you should have just a delta function at the chemical potential, because you've gone from ground state to ground state in an adiabatic way. What we see is that the peak gets bigger as you increase the photon energy and go towards the sudden limit. So I rather think that what we're seeing is a bulk surface difference rather than, you know, some effect of that transition. As far as the details of the matrix element go, I guess I can say that as we change the photon energy, what we seem to be seeing is that the entire D band kind of goes up and down relative to the oxygen band without a lot of shape changes going on, except for this surface bulk stuff. So, you know, at some level, I have the sense that we haven't done a bad job on the issues that you're raising, but maybe eventually we would compare things at such a level of detail that we would really worry about the theory of photoemission. I think it's true statement that there's no many-body theory, one-step photoemission process with all realism put in.
Obviously, you want to put eventually the dynamical matrix theory into the photoemission theory, but even before that, not expecting necessarily to get all the details in there, as you say, a truly one electron, nevertheless, a fully first principles theory, which is has no parameters in it, and then you will find out about the matrix element effects, polarization effects, and a whole lot of details, which then with your mind eyes, you can transfer to the other calculation.
Yes, I think you're thinking of the kind of thing that Lindruss and his colleagues have done in the cuprates, and I think that's not been done for V203.
Yes, I have a question on this picture that you have with increasing photon energy.
Yes. I think it's probably easier to just flash back through since computers are... Maybe that one?
Yes. I wanted to analyze where the intensity is going to saturate, or if you would expect it to keep on growing.
Well,
and the second question is, if you can give us a feeling of your noise to signal ratio to see if that little tiny thing that is coming up in the 700 dB curve.
Oh, this thing?
Be a genuine feature, or just
I know what you're thinking of course. That's not a genuine feature. That's in the noise. I think that's a true statement. I'm pretty sure that's in the noise. Of course, he is alluding to the importance of well, you have a factor of two difference in width here between the theory and the experiment. You would like a lower energy scale to make the phase transition work. So he is wondering if perhaps what you have here is some kind of, that this is really the quasi-particle peak. And it has a width that's narrow like in the dynamic mean field theory and would then have an energy scale that would be helpful for the transition. And I think it's not true. I mean, I'd like it, but I think it's not so. Will this saturate? Well, I already showed you one spectrum taken on a special surface at 300 dB, which was just a little bit taller. But I can also tell you that if we had only surface layer effects at 700 dB for escape depths that we sort of know about, there shouldn't be more than another 10 or 15% coming. So I don't think this is going to turn out to look like that. maybe I'll get shocked again, but I don't think so.
Have you made any separation between vanadium D-states and oxygen D-states? For example, here, are those two peaks shown identified with whatever, which ones are D-states, which are P-states?
Well, nominally, this is the oxygen P-band, and this is the vanadium 3D stuff. Now, I mentioned to you that underlying this would be our sense of the Anderson impurity model, that you probably start out with a D2 to D1 peak that might be here, and then you turn on the hybridization, and you blow the spectral weight out down to there. And this is then the stuff that becomes the LDA calculation for the bands, and which we are taking and putting dynamic mean field theory on. But if you would go back one step to bareness, to the kind of models that George and I and Jan Zanon used to make this phase diagram, then we would probably have put the bare level back there. And so this has certainly some oxygen character in it. But these tricks that we do with resonant photoemission, which, let's see, where are they? So I showed you this kind of stuff where you can turn on a resonance and see this huge vanadium. This is surely vanadium 3D stuff coming up here in the resonance. And if it weren't for the Auger, I would then swear to you we had done a good job of picking out the 3D stuff. But they are different at kind of this level. So this is a comparison of the line shape on resonance. That's the red one. You'll notice that the statistics are better. And the blue one. So I'm pretty sure that by making these kinds of comparisons and knowing what part's the Auger, I can tell you what part is the 3D part.
Now that you've gotten all these nice data and identified the quasi-particle peak in the metal, do you think that it's now possible to make at least a qualitative comparison to optics?
Next step. I think there will be some interesting confrontations because the work that's been done already by you and Gabi and Rosenberg and others will want a smaller U value than is now being used in the dynamic mean field theory, because you see a peak which you think is something like 2U, and then that's just coming at a lower energy. So,
I
see. Yes, we would like, of course, then to have photoemission. We would like to have inverse photoemission in order to really do that well. At the moment, there are some BIS spectra taken by Jaehoon Park, but the resolution's pretty bad. It's like a half a volt. That's about as good as most people can do. We have data taken from oxygen 1s to 2p absorption, which can be interpreted as showing you something like the spectrum to add a particle to the system, but that again doesn't maybe have the resolution you want. So we don't really have quite the set of data that you would like to do what you want to do. But that doesn't mean we couldn't do anything and won't have a look.
Last question.
Is the double peak structure in the display space for this crystal structure?
What exactly do you have in mind by crystal? Do you mean because it's a single site theory. And so, well, when I mentioned the idea that perhaps pairs are important, this would be a beginning of an effort to build in some more local correlations. And there are, in fact, some calculations like that being done by Sasha and... We're not far enough along to do that. I think that's just... But for sure, people are thinking along those lines and wondering if that could help.
Thank you very much. Thank you.